Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 290. What goes into managing a major project? What techniques can you employ for a project that's in crisis? Christopher Trudeau is back on the show this week with another batch of PyCoders Weekly articles and projects. We discuss an article by Ben Kuhn titled How I've Run Major Projects. We dig into the skills required for project management and provide advice for when projects fall into crisis. We cover how the field's terminology has been updated. However, the time investment, sober communication, and planning still remain at the core of successful projects. We also share other articles and projects from the Python community, including recent releases and announcements, exploring an IDE for data science development, using Python set comprehensions, making friendly classes, using @exit for cleanup, a high-performance caching library for Python written in Rust, and a curated list of awesome Marimo things. This podcast is brought to you by Propel Auth. Propel Auth is an easy-to-use authentication system for your B2B product. Learn more at www.propelauth.com. That's www.propelauth.com. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Chris. Welcome back.
Hey there.
All right. So we got a very similar setup as usual this week. Got a couple pieces of news, topics, a discussion, and projects. Are you ready to dig in?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right.
Two things in the news. First off, Starlet made 1.0. For those not familiar, Starlet is an ASGI framework. Nothing like explaining something with an acronym that requires explaining itself. Yes. ASGI is a Python standard for doing asynchronous web services. Most Python web frameworks use WSGI or ASGI as their underlying mechanism, usually to connect to a web server like Nginx or Apache, something like that, that then does the heavy lifting. Starlet is a service itself. And FastAPI, amongst others, are built on top of it. So congrats to the Starlet folks on the 1.0 release. I have a sneaking suspicion that my oversimplification of that tech explanation is going to make somebody cranky with the but actuallys. Seeing as I got crap for talking down vegetables last time, you know, you never can tell. The next announcement is less likely to get me in trouble. The PyOhio conference has issued its call for proposals. Submissions are open until April 20th. The conference itself is July 25th and 26th at Cleveland State University Student Center in Cleveland, Ohio.
We are officially in conference season.
Yes, it has started. Yeah. And we've mentioned this before, but if you're new to the conference space and you want to try out giving a talk, these small regional ones are great places to start.
Yeah, definitely. And there's a boatload of them.
And they're coming. Yep.
All right. Well, that takes us into topics. I've been featuring some new writers, new authors, if you will, at Real Python, and I got another one. This first piece is by Mark Pedigo, and he's involved in writing stuff about data science here at Real Python, and so I'm excited to share his first piece. It's titled Spider, that's spelled S-P-Y-D-E-R, Your IDE for Data Science Development in Python. Spider is a tool that I think many data scientists have used or have come across, at least been exposed to it. It comes as part of an installation of Anaconda. It's actually part of the PyData ecosystem. It liberally takes its name from Scientific Python Development Environment, stealing letters from the various words there. I have messed with it a little bit. This is something when I was getting into my first like real Python job, I was, again, I say this a lot, but we were using R and we were using Python, and a lot of the Python developers there really like Spider. I was actually kind of mixing between that and not only RStudio, but also Jupyter. In a lot of cases, it depended on who I was kind of coordinating with. There's an alternative piece from Posit you might be interested in if you're looking for a tool like this. So if you're looking for an IDE that's geared toward data science and the whole sort of life cycle of working in a data science project, I think it's a good tool for you to check out. I'll cover a few of my favorite things about it as I talk through this tour. And Mark's really kind of just providing a tour of sort of the functions and showing off what you can kind of do with it. It's definitely not a super deep dive into this. It's a fairly short piece to kind of give you a taste of what to do with it. But it also includes some tutorial elements and some code to get going. And so he starts off installing it. There's a variety of ways you can do that. You can do it as a standalone thing from their dedicated download page, or you can actually get it from Conda, or he also shows you getting it from PyPI, along with a variety of packages that you're going to use in the example. Takes you through the interface. It opens up and it's divided, like a lot of IDEs, into multiple panes. In this case, there's a main pane on the left side, which is kind of your, you know, main file where you'd see your code. And then on the right, the two other panes there, there's a console, which is an IPython console. Again, kind of being as part of that PyData family there. And then along with that, there's this other one that is one of the more interesting areas that he dives much deeper into. It includes help, a debugger, a files sort of browser kind of thing, a tool for finding stuff and doing code analysis. And then this is the thing that excited me the most about this. Again, when I was diving into data science and I was working in a marketing department, and so I was dealing with a lot of text from very different databases, and the quality of cleanliness of this stuff was all over the place. And so there's a tool inside there called the Variable Explorer. And I really liked it because it was nice to be able to not just, you know, move information into a data frame and then try to look at it in like a Jupyter window or other kinds of things like that, or a REPL. And it's, you know, it's just difficult. Sometimes you just want to have kind of the features of a spreadsheet, if you will, to be able to kind of move things around and look at it. We spent some time a couple weeks ago digging into exploratory data analysis and some tools that you could do this sort of EDA thing with that. And those are great because they're automated and they can get you through a lot of what you might want to look for or try to find and get quick ideas of it. But sometimes you want to, again, depending on the data set, you may want to comb through it manually and see how things take shape. As part of the tour, he takes you into downloading weather history data set from Kaggle. And then you import that data into your session inside of Spider using pandas and the read CSV method. So now you got a variable. So in the Variable Explorer, you can see the list of all the different variables, and a data frame is one of them. And as you click on that to sort of open it up, it really shows it much more like a spreadsheet. And you can filter or sort or exclude certain variables. It's really kind of a nice way to comb through the data. I guess it really depends on the size of your data set and what you're looking at, but you could also use a smaller subset. I like that. That was something I was doing a lot manually. I don't know how many other data scientists do that or how big their data sets are, but I've kind of find it handy. It even lets you insert rows or adjust columns, and it's all kind of happening in that version of the data set inside of memory, even letting you edit individual values, things that you can't necessarily do inside of a typical data frame. The next feature that is, again, sort of unique to it is a plots pane. It displays static snapshots of your plots with quick overviews, and then you can cycle through them. You can move forward and backward, enlarge them, zoom them in, zoom them out. You can also undock that window and move it over to maybe a separate monitor if you'd like. And then another feature that I liked about it, a lot of IDEs have like a debugger built in, which is really nice. This has that also. He doesn't focus on that, but one thing that they don't usually have is like a built-in profiler, and this has one. You can determine the runtime and the number of calls of each function or methods in the file. You can identify performance bottlenecks in your code, and then you can sort of save and compare profiling results across runs. He takes you through an example of extracting like a subset of that weather data and does it with like a for loop, which is not very performant usually, right? And then optimizing that process by using an optimized pandas method for the task. So the last section shares some limitations and gotchas of using it. The tool, again, really isn't geared toward the workflows that a lot of Python developers look for in an IDE. I would say you're not going to use this if you're going to do web development. You probably could, but it's just not really geared for that type of thing, or maybe big deployment kind of things. It's, again, more for this sort of exploratory data science-y kinds of things where you're working with those types of tools. And a comparison to another tool in this space is Posit has created their own recent IDE. It's called Positron, and that might be worth a look. It's built off of Code OSS, which is the foundation of VS Code, but is open source, as the name implies there. And it creates a similar set of data science focused tools, data exploration, plot pane, et cetera. If you've used VS Code before, maybe this would be a little friendlier, more familiar to you. Note that, like VS Code, it is an Electron app, so that there's some little bit of weight there as far as using it. The other option, I guess, would be a notebook type of thing. You know, you could look at Jupyter, or I'll hint it right now. I'm going to talk a little bit about Marimo a little bit more at the end here. So thanks, Mark.
It's a little bit ironic that Electron is named after one of the lighter particles.
Yeah, having used Slack, and gosh, what else? Trello, a variety of tools that kind of turn to apps. I have not gotten good at just using them inside of a web browser. I kind of like having them as separate tools, but lightweight they are not.
Yes.
All right, what do you got for your first one?
My first article is also from RealPython, and it's by Leodonis Pozo-Ramos, a not-so-new author. I actually just finished turning one of his into a course, so it seems like I've been spending a fair amount of quality time with him lately.
Yeah.
This article is titled, Python Set Comprehensions, How and When to Use Them. Let's do a bit of quick background first. Set in Python is one of the lesser used built-in data types, and it's like a mathematical set, an unordered bucket of objects that can have at most one of each thing. They're a very handy way of ensuring you don't have duplicates in a collection of data. You can create a set using a constructor or using brace brackets. The brace brackets can be kind of tricky, as that's also the way you create dictionaries. Like with the dictionary, you have a comma-separated collection of values. Unlike the dictionary, each thing is a single value rather than a key-value pair. A comprehension in Python is a special kind of expression that creates data collections. Python supports four comprehensions: lists, dictionaries, generators, and of course, sets. Comprehensions look kind of like an inline for loop. For a set comprehension, you use brace brackets. Then inside of that, the pattern goes like this. Expression for item in iterable. This is one of those times when a podcast isn't the best medium, but let's try an example. Again, in brace brackets, x times 2 for x in range 0 to 10. That says to loop over the numbers from 0 to 9 inclusive and multiply each one by 2, putting the result in the set. In addition to this, you can also add a conditional that goes after the iterable. It's of the format if condition. So back to our example, I would change it. So now it's x times 2 for x in range 0, 10 for x mod 4 equals 0, meaning x times 2 only gets added to the set if it's also divisible by 4. The article starts out with the different ways you can create a set, then covers what I just went over, how to write set comprehensions, then spends a bit of time talking about when to use a comprehension. Due to compiler optimization, they tend to be a bit faster than an equivalent for loop, but if your comprehension starts being multi-line, it can be hard to read, so, you know, coding has trade-offs. The article finishes off by detailing things you want to avoid. Leodonis mentions four bad practices. The first two are using overly complex expressions and using nested expressions, both of which make your code hard to read. The third bad practice is more a forbidden practice. The scope of the variables inside the comprehension is the comprehension. So if you need to access the variable after the calculation has run, well, you can't. So then you'd have to switch back to using a for loop if you've got to get at that data afterwards. The last bad practice is about running costly transformations when building sets. My example was x times 2, which is pretty cheap, but your case might involve something fancier. This can have performance implications, and for overly complicated transformations, you might want to use a generator, which creates the values on the fly rather than suffering the cost of building the entire set up front. So if you're new to sets or comprehensions, there's lots of good examples here that you can sink your teeth into.
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago, I covered one of Trey Hunter's pieces about the different types of comprehensions and then using the generators, which you just mentioned before, to make types of comprehensions that you wouldn't normally think of, like a tuple one. So if you are wanting a little more information, there's some more details there. A bad auth provider is like a bad marriage. You may hate your partner, but you make it work for the kids, aka users. Unfortunately, no one ends up happy in the end. Don't get stuck in a bad relationship with your auth provider. Choose Propel Auth from day one and live happily ever after. Learn more at propelauth.com. That's www.propelauth.com. And that takes me to my story this week. My next topic here, which is Trey Hunter on his Python Morsel site, has a piece. It's titled Making Friendly Classes. As every longtime listener of the show who is familiar with Python, everything in Python is an object.
You did that nice and slowly. He's looking in the camera like, you're going to have to hit the button.
Yeah, yeah. Get ready. I didn't raise my hand or anything. Many users of Python will not need to create or invent any classes of their own. Like, if you're going to construct or instantiate some of these of their own objects, you know, you can use Python for quite a while, you know, making scripts and solving smaller problems. It's not a requirement to do that, but I think it's not uncommon for people as they go along their journey to say, all right, well, what can we do with object-oriented programming in Python and think about it a little bit more? And I think this is a nice set of guidelines from Trey. It kind of is this interesting article where he bounces back and forth between another piece that he's written. And so what does he mean by friendly? He kind of means more user-friendly. And he has these three qualities that they should have when you're creating a class. The objects that you create from them, they accept sensible arguments. Your class should also, instances should have a nice string representation, and instances can be sensibly compared to one another. And then he has an optional thing. When it makes sense, they embrace dunder methods to overload other functionality. Dunder methods are special methods. The dunder stands for double underscore. You probably heard us talk about this a few times if you've listened to the show. In fact, these three different things are related to that a little bit. The string representation uses a dunder method of double underscore REPR double underscore, sort of standing for representation. And it's what you get when you, if you were in a REPL and you just typed the name of the variable you created, that instance of that object, it would print out what could be, if you've done it properly, you could actually feed that in to create another object based upon that. I'll cover that a little bit more. But he provides a common example of using a point in this case of in 3D space. So the X, Y, and Z values for how it is represented in three-dimensional space. He doesn't call it friendly because of how it looks implementation-wise, but more about how it behaves. It accepts sensible arguments. So in this case, is quick example is P equals, again, the class name is point, and then you could put in 1, 2, 3. So again, sensibly can receive arguments into it. The string representation then, if you were to, again, just type P inside of like a REPL, you'd get the class point, and then in parentheses, X equals 1, Y equals 2, Z equals 3. Again, you could use that to instantiate another object of the same type right there. It's very readable to a developer, you know, when you think about that. A friendly class also has these the support for sensible equality checks. So it's using these built-in dunder methods. The one that we're using there is dunder EQ. And so it's a way of being able to compare two objects to each other. He dives a little bit further into, like, if you'd like to learn more about the special methods, he has links to that. And I'll actually include some real Python stuff on that. These three dunder methods, the first one, dunder repr for the representation, and then dunder EQ, the one I didn't mention is in the dunder init. That's where you're accepting those variables in that. So you're using those three when you're setting up your class. Again, hard to do here, just speaking out loud. Again, I'll provide some resources here, and he has links that go much deeper in each one of those types of things. But he takes this detour on a parallel topic. If you want to make a friendly class quickly, you might want to try using a data class and the data class decorator. And the structure for a data class is really clean. We've mentioned them off and on the show before, but you need to import data class from the data class's built-in library. Once you've done that, you then have access to a decorator, the at data class decorator, and you'd put that right above where you start to define your class. So you'd say class, space, point, colon, and then below that, you define the different variables that you're taking into it. And so in this case, what's interesting is you simply type X, colon, and then it adds one extra thing, which is type checking. So you, in this case, he's using a float. So X colon float, Y colon float, Z colon float on separate lines just below that. So it looks pretty elegant when you look at a data class. And what's interesting is it does all the things that we just mentioned, plus sort of adds this sort of type checking element to it. Data classes are this abstraction on top of Python's regular class syntax. They were introduced in Python 3.7. Abstractions come with trade-offs. Some functionality is automatic, which means you get it for free, but it's also sort of hidden away from you. And if you wondered like what it would take to write this class that's equivalent to a given data class, he has a whole thing on it where he has a tool. It's called undata class, and it sort of expands the data class into like a regular class sort of definition. So you can kind of see all that work that's being done. Again, the idea of abstraction is really nice, but if you don't understand how it works. So he's kind of doing that tour. Not all the friendliness is the same. Do all classes need to implement Dunder EQ? Will you always be comparing your objects or checking for equality? He uses like a database connection as an example, or checking two logging objects or something like that. Usually you're going to be like comparing in the case of point, you know, are these two equal to each other? I think it's like a thing where if the objects are more about methods than, say, the parameters that we're sort of defining them, does it need a fancier string representation? So these are things you might think about. At the end of the article, he digs into how you can continue to make your class a little friendlier, more useful, again, to users. He states that Python's classes support over 100 other Dunder methods, so there's lots and lots of special methods you can get into, but maybe don't go overboard. Not only would make it unwieldy, but also less friendly. In his conclusion, he reiterates that data classes are a good measure as to sort of what works well. If you think about it, it's really what made sense to the people that were writing this structure inside of Python 3.7. What would be, you know, make a usable abstraction and so forth. So a lot of thought went into that. Next time you create a class, he says, make sure to ask yourself, is my class at least friendly as an equivalent data class? If you want to know a little bit more on data classes, friend of the show, Gerard Ayala, wrote some good tutorials on Real Python. He has data classes in Python. It's a guide for it and dives very, very deep. He wrote that back when Python 3.7 was coming out. But yeah, I think you're a fan of data classes.
I've had mixed use with them. I find there are certain situations where it's like, oh, that solves all sorts of problems for me. And then I find, okay, I'll use a data class. And I'm like, oh, wait, now I need inheritance. And that's going to screw this and this and this up. And so there's like a 25% of the time my data classes have to be undone so that I can do something fancier with the objects.
You might use this tool to expand it.
Yeah, so... Friendly wise, I'm fairly anal retentive about Dunder Upper and Dunder String.
Yeah,
Dunder Equal. I only do it if the abstraction is something I'm after, right? So like if you're building something that represents something that's mathematical, where you're going to be doing comparisons.
Yeah,
but I don't find I do it by default.
I mean, it's in the name, data class. You know, you think about like these are values versus like functionality, and those are kind of different paths that you would go in creating classes. And you know, again, sometimes you're inheriting some of that. But yeah, it's an interesting little sort of short article from him that kind of dives into this concepts. I like that he gives lots of off ramps in his stuff to like, okay, do you want to dig further into any of these? All right, well, what do you got for us next?
My next one's kind of short, but it contains something that I always forget exists, so I thought I'd pass it along. Maybe now I'll remember. The article's by Divakar Patil, and it's titled How to Use Python's @exit module for cleanup in networked applications. Sometimes when your program exits, you want to run some cleanup code, and depending on your program, you might be able to do that when the user hits the quit button, but there is another way. The @exit module allows you to register one or more functions to be called when the program exits. This is done by passing a function reference into @exit's register handler call, and that's more or less it. When your code is done, Python calls the registered function for you, letting you do whatever you needed to do before things close. There are a few caveats. First, this doesn't get called if there's an exception. It doesn't get called if someone control C's your program or if the exit is triggered by OS exit. So it's useful for clean exits, but not for messy ones. most of the article is actually an example. Divakar demonstrates how all of this works through two programs, a client and a server. The server uses a database. The client connects to the server via a socket. And when the socket gets closed, the server is finished. And the at exit mechanism is used to properly close the database in the server. So if you find this stuff interesting, I'll point you at two more things as well. First, there are ways of trapping interrupt signals like control C. So you could write a signal handler as well as the at exit handler. Second, the at exit takes a reference to a function, which means the function can't take arguments. But the functools module has a feature called partials that allows you to wrap functions with a reference, getting around this restriction. The article's example is solid and worth checking out to learn more. It really is mostly the code, but it's a really well-constructed example, so it's worth taking a look.
It's time to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course. It's about a topic we touch on in this week's episode, data classes, and how they can simplify the creation of a class that typically contains mainly data, although there aren't really any restrictions. And with data classes, you don't have to write boilerplate code to get proper initialization, representation, and comparisons for your objects. The course is based on a RealPython guide by Gerarna Hiela and is presented by instructor Darren Jones. By the end of the course, you'll know how to define your own data classes, add default values to fields in your data classes, customize the ordering of data class objects, work with immutable data classes, inheritance and subclassing, and ways to optimize your data classes. I think it's a worthy investment of your time to learn how to make user-friendly classes for containing data and write less code. Like most of the video courses on RealPython, this course is broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, has code samples for the technique shown. All our lessons include transcripts, including closed captions. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. So we do have a discussion again this week. You picked this one out. I'm going to try to introduce it as much as I can. We're discussing a blog post by Ben Kuhn. It's from his site, benkuhn.net, and it's titled How I've Run Major Projects. So it's really about project management, but it starts with explaining how he has had some of his most productive weeks during crisis project management. Think excellent project management is also rarer than it needs to be, which I think is an interesting statement. And he kind of then shares like a playbook of what to do. So I'll kind of bounce through some different sections and kind of give an idea of some of the basics here, but it's a good read. If you haven't done project management or you're looking at it, or you're now escalating to a crisis level of project management, I think some of these things might be really helpful. He starts talking about focus, needing to clear the schedule if you're in crisis management. It's not always intuitive that information processing is time intensive. It may not be like coding, but it has many, many parts: checking statuses, contemplating priorities, broadcasting updates, etc. He talks about maintaining a detailed plan for victory. It made me think about, I did take a course on project management and they were very focused around Microsoft Project at that time and Gantt charts, if you have never heard that word, G-A-A-N-T, which I don't know if a lot of people in the tech world are using as much, which is kind of intriguing to me. He didn't really mention it very much at all inside of here, but it's a tool that, you know, literally lets you schedule out and apply resources and have calendar kind of views of like, well, where is everything happening and are we meeting our goals? He talks about the, you know, the concept of checking in frequently, even enough that against the plan, once we've made it, or something would sound an alarm if things went off plan. He describes something called an OODA loop, which stands for observe, orient, decide, and then act. In other words, the process by which you update your plans and behavior based on whatever new information comes up. Stepping back and reorienting frequently is something he mentions a few times here. And then breaking off sub-projects, I thought was interesting. So once a project gets over maybe 10 people, I can track everything myself in enough detail to project manage the entire thing myself. But at this point, when you get above 10, this is where you might need to start doing something else and delegating project management and maybe not just the execution of it. The best project managers are often not the strongest technical ICs, or I guess individual contributors, right? Instead of the most important traits are that they're highly organized and great at staying laser focused on end goals, perhaps to the point of being annoying about it. Directionality is often more important than magnitude, I think is a good quote from it too. And then he tries to focus on certain things of like having fun while doing this, even though you're in crisis mode, keeping goals simple. And then probably the most useful thing he has at the tail of it, in my opinion, beyond a lot of the advice above it, is he has some very, very specific, he has like a starter kit. He calls it the DRI starter kit. I had to look that up, directly responsible individual. So that's the person who is basically the project manager and, you know, is responsible for delivering this thing.
You're not the only one who had to look it up. One, I had to look it up. Two, there's a comment on the blog saying, what is this? No one explains what it is.
Yeah. So yeah, DRI was not that common. I had to think of the punk band, sorry. He talks about the tools that he uses in that, a weekly meeting, how he runs that and kind of organizes it. The idea of having a working doc. I think of other tools, you know, Kanban boards and things like that. A whole bunch of rules around what you should do if you're using a tool like Slack, which I think is pretty common. I'd like to get your input on that here in a minute. He mentioned something called avoiding centa threads. To me, centa would be 100 threads, but he says greater than 10 is like, you really do not want to have that. You really want to break it apart. And then avoiding DMing people, like if you're going to do something, make a private channel with them potentially, but otherwise it should probably be in public. And then how he kind of runs retrospectives, which it's a lot of information, which I think is nice as a download of this, though it is very jargony. So what are some of your thoughts? Like why were you like interested in sharing this? I've done some project management. I've done it in very interesting ways. My teams are never quite this big.
Yeah. So he doesn't use the words lean or agile, but he's definitely heavily influenced by it. Not clear to me whether he knows that, whether it's been tools he's learned from other people. You mentioned the OODA. You're allowed to pronounce that. It's OODA. It's much more fun to say. But it goes along
with... Makes you think of cheese then.
It goes along with something called the PDCA, which is Plan, Do, Check, Act. These are similar mechanisms, which essentially... The thinking is, and this is sort of at the root of the argument of waterfall versus agile. Waterfall works well if you know exactly what you're doing. And the reality of it is, for most software projects, we don't know exactly what we're doing. And you know, the more planning you do up front isn't necessarily going to allow you to see the future, and therefore you end up having to change things anyways.
Going to be iterating.
So OODA and PDCA loops basically say, do smaller chunks at a time. We're going to do a little bit of planning. We're going to do some execution. We're going to check whether or not the execution worked. Then we're going to act to change our behavior so that we can get better. So these are very much lean and agile kind of things.
Okay.
And I think that's, you know, you made the comment about the Gantt charts, and although they are still somewhat useful, they tend to be one of those
things
that are used
thing.
With waterfall because you're planning the whole thing up front. So there are equivalent tools that you can use, but they don't surface as much in the agile world because that's all upfront planning, right? So he's got a lot of, you know, that kind of stuff that's there. There are, even ignoring the process side of things, there's some good advice in here, right? You know, I love the phrase, communicate uncomfortably much. The grammar's a little off, but it's one of those things, like when you're a project manager, you're better off constantly broadcasting and then have somebody saying, you're talking too much, and like then and toning it down for them, because under communication is a source of all sorts of problems. And so like a good habit is like, you know, one of the things you can do is you can try to figure out who your stakeholders are.
Yeah.
And for different kinds of stakeholders, you communicate differently. So you've got people that you're interacting with every day. That's the Slack channel. And then you've got people who want to see how the project's going, but you're not interacting with every day. A weekly newsletter for them is fantastic. And it doesn't have to be overly long. You don't have to explain how the developers did what they're doing, but you can say, we built this thing. You can now do this. This is the, you know, these are what we're expecting to tackle next week, right? That's part of that over communication thing. And honestly, whether you're waterfall or agile, that's good stuff.
Yeah. He talks about the time he spends on stuff, like, you know, 6+ hours of the work day is just literally following up and staying in that loop of, like, doing stuff.
Project management is a full-time job.
That's what it is.
It's often problematic for software team leads who are having to do some project management as well as are expected to still contribute code. It's hard to do both. And it's one of those things where if you're doing it well and everything's running smoothly, people are like, oh, what does he do all day? and when it goes badly, everyone's right. Like, we need help, right? Yeah. It's a hard thing to sort of work with.
I think it'd be funny to use those words in different formats and questions and answer. Much uncomfortable communicate? Much communicate uncomfortable.
Yes.
So
you mentioned Slack.
Yeah. Were you using that with your teams?
Yeah. So this is one of those things I struggle with. I find there are good places for things like Slack and there are good places for things like email. And I don't know how much of this is a personal thing and how much of this is just some people don't really understand when to use one versus when to use the other.
Right.
And
the reply all people.
Yeah. I am conscious that I'm an old man and therefore email to me is the right answer in certain kinds of places. The challenge with Slack is like longevity. And, I find it, you and I communicate with the video courses over Slack. Most of that is done DM because we're the only two working, so we don't need a separate channel for it. But I find frequently I'm like, well, there was that thing, and when did we talk about that? And even with it just being the two of us, finding something from a month ago is difficult.
Yeah.
And well-done email where you've got like a subject line and contents, it's a little more formal.
Yeah.
I find that's much more searchable. But I know lots of people who are horrible at writing the subject line and, you know, and you get the thread thing and it's problematic. You know, I've got friends who are going through this now at their work where the boss is big on the instant message thing and the boss can't even track themselves what they've asked for. And this is where good project management comes in, right? Like you need to, that we can have that conversation via Slack, but we need to put an item in a list somewhere and we have to agree what's in the list and we have to agree on the priorities in the list because otherwise it doesn't exist. And so a lot of it depends on what you're using Slack for. The other aspect of it too is, and again, this is like a discipline thing, but if you've got a noisy channel, people have to use Threads properly. Because if they're not, you've got like four messages in a row that are acting like a thread, and then somebody brings up a new topic, and then somebody's answering the old one, and it's makes it that much harder to keep track of what's going on. Whereas if you're a little more disciplined about actually using reply threads, then that kind of, that makes the first message essentially the subject line. But again, people tend to be sloppy about this kind of stuff. So, we are our own worst enemies with these tools.
Yeah. I'm not a huge fan of it. It's a part of the internet that I did not use as much. I was not like on message boards.
Yeah.
And stuff like that.
I didn't do a lot of IRC, which is really all Slack reinvented, right? So same thing. And it's not Slack specific. Like we use Basecamp at Real Python. It's the same, the same challenge. A lot of people use Discord. When I wrote code with the textual framework,
McGugan.
He's got a fantastic Discord server. People are very, very helpful. He's always on it. He's very, very helpful, but it's really busy. And so you'll ask a question, you'll be stuck, and then like five more questions pop up, and then you're having to like dig, when did the reply happen, and is it connected to this or not? And it's just, it makes it hard to sort of surface actionable information.
Yeah. The types of projects that I've done at Real Python have been, we use the Trello as our tool because we're creating these projects that are small chunks of things like video courses, and it makes sense that that's a card and it can move across the columns and move forward, or I think a newsroom would be similar, as far as articles, and obviously our tutorials are like that. And I try to use that for the podcast as much as I can. And sometimes it's nebulous how you want to organize things. The idea of having this large document I thought was intriguing. I almost would like to see an example of what one would look like if they could anonymize it enough.
So what he's talking about was more of a landing page is really what it comes down to.
So what does that mean?
So the idea is you should have one place that has the lead into all the other places.
Okay.
So if you've got a Trello board that you're using on the project or multiple Trello boards for different parts of it, if you've got a bug tracking system, if you've got a project plan, if you've got a requirements mechanism, whatever those things are, there should be a project homepage that includes links to those things. So when I don't know where something is, I can go to the project's homepage and it can say, here are the contributors. Oh, okay. Bailey's our data scientist. Okay, I have a data science question. I will look Bailey up and go from there, right?
Okay.
And, you know, particularly in large organizations, you're running something like Jira and every single team's got its own Jira board. And then you've got multiple teams involved in a project. Well, how do you find what team is working on something and that kind of stuff? So having a central location for the company that is active projects and then being able to look at the active project page and go, okay, this is whatever. We're building teleportation. So you go to the teleportation homepage and on it says, okay, there's a Trello board here for the hardware. There's a Trello board here for the software. You know, here are your team leads. Here's your PM. So that information
is test somewhere. Subjects.
Yeah. And this is where we're buying rabbits from. Yeah. If I got trouble for vegetables, testing on animals is going to get me in all sorts of trouble.
It's Easter, man. What are you doing?
So it basically just allows somebody who's new to the project or somebody who, you know, is a stakeholder who isn't deeply focused on the project to be able to find stuff easily is really what it comes down to.
I think of SharePoint, if it was done well. I'm not a fan.
Where data goes to die.
Yeah. But I mean, that is premise-wise, this is like they might be using
SharePoint's just a tool for building web pages from that perspective, right? It's a way of organizing the information.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, they say go to our SharePoint and that shows our org and links out to all this sort of stuff. But there's lots of ways you could do that.
Yeah. Information architecture is a tricky discipline and very few people do it well. Hmm. Yeah.
I always think of that as like learning and documentation.
They're connected.
Yeah.
It's how you're hierarchically representing the information.
Yeah.
How it's organized, where I can find things, how to cross link things so that I know how to find stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny because like before Google, the answer to everything was like in email clients, it was always, well, put it in a folder. And then you ran into this problem of, okay, well, what if this covers two things? Do I put it in this folder? Do I copy it in another folder? Then Gmail comes out and they go, oh, it's all search and it's all labels. And for the first, I'd say decade, this worked beautifully. And now, unfortunately, we've got so much data that search is become problematic again because, you know, like I find this right now, it's like, we're about to do a reno at our condo. And so there's been a lot of back and forth with the construction company, with the building, all the rest of it. And I search on something and I get like 15 email messages that could be the one I'm looking for. And there's a lot of like hunting through it, right? Because every single one of them has the exact same keywords in it and then you're in trouble, right? So
I guess one of the things like the crisis of it all, do you agree with some of these things of like, okay, yes, you need to be constantly checking in, staying on top of things, you know, delegating if you get beyond like a certain number of reports or whatever. Are these things that ring true to you?
Yeah, crisis or not, I think it's the same thing. Like the communication is really, really important. If you're communicating well, you tend to have fewer escalations because the things that they're escalating is, you know, people get lost and then they're, why isn't this being worked on? Well, if it's very, very clear that there are five things ahead of you in the queue and it's very, very clear who the business sponsors are for each of those five things, well, you can scream all you like. Yeah. I'm going to take you and we're going to have a conversation with those five people. And if they want to let you ahead of them in the queue, then that's great. No problem. Right. But communicating the current state of things and where things are helps you. And so when crisis does happen, people do know, you know, why it's a priority, how it's working, that kind of stuff, right? So he touches very, very briefly on the idea of a retrospective. This is one of the things, like, I pound on it when I'm teaching this stuff all the time. I'm like, if you take one thing out of my Agile classes, it's start doing retros and do them well. Because that idea of spending an hour every week or two to figure out how to get better, there's value to that, right?
Right.
And that a little bit of introspective time, the team has to take it seriously, and that sometimes is hard to get done. But you know, that idea of continuous improvement comes out of, you know, how do we get better? How do we fix things? How do we make sure this doesn't happen again? You know, if we're always in crisis mode and we don't take a little bit of time to have that conversation, we can't expect to improve.
Yeah, you're not learning from any of the mistakes. You're just gonna repeat them.
And just loop back, complete tangential thing, but just something you talked about before. You know, you're talking about Trello. Those are Kanban boards. The other thing I find is really, really powerful is you can have hierarchies of Kanban boards.
Okay.
So if you've got multiple teams working on different parts of things, you can have like a feature level Kanban board where you've got a higher level abstract card that says, we're building this feature. Yeah. And then in that card, it says teams A, B, and C are working on that. And then the teams each have their own Kanban boards for the parts of those features that you're working on. Mm. And in fact, you can go higher than that inside of large organizations. You can do things like at the project or at the portfolio level. And so essentially, you always end up with a card that abstracts the thing that you're working on. And it's just at the high levels, that thing might be something that 100 people are actually touching. And at the lower level, you're always at the level of about 10 people or less. And this makes it extremely expandable and extremely scalable.
Yeah. I feel like the missing ingredient that the project manager, you really got to focus on if you're going to put somebody in that position, is they really got to be good at communication to the point that everybody is comfortable talking to them, that they're willing to share vulnerable stuff to them.
Yeah.
And they're not, I guess it depends on the organization, but like, you know, aggressiveness and so forth is not going to work out.
there needs to be a lot of trust.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if I've worked with good PMs who are the people you want in the room when something goes wrong, because they get the right people in the room and, you know, they get a conversation going. And then I've worked with the ones that squeeze the nickel until it bleeds. And right. It's all about Gantt charts. And, you know, the ones help you have a more effective organization and the others are a necessary evil, like your vegetables. I'm just not letting that go. I know what my problem is.
Yeah. yeah, I mean, you don't want people hiding things from you and, and what's actually happening. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, we're going to dig into some projects here ourselves. I mentioned and hinted on this earlier that I was going to talk about Marimo. And if you're not familiar with it, here's a blurb from Marimo's site. The notebook reinvented. Marimo feels like a notebook, but is stored as a pure Python program that's Git friendly, reusable as a module, executable as a script, shareable as an app, reproducible in execution, and packaging and designed for data. And it's all open source. So I'm a big fan. And if you'd like to learn a little bit more about it, I did a podcast episode with Akshay, the guy who kind of invented it with his team there, episode 230. And then actually Mr. Trudeau did a video course on Marimo.
Yeah.
And used it recently for an astronomy data science course.
Yes.
So yeah, a couple of different stuff.
It's a fun tool.
So they have created and curated a awesome Marimo things list. Awesome Marimo, curated list of awesome Marimo things. And I think some people may not be familiar with an awesome list. So I thought briefly I'd mention, like, you know, what are they? They're this collection of resources. Say you want to learn more. Okay, well, here's links to all kinds of tutorials, guides, documentation, or courses on the thing. Templates get you started quickly. Additional resources, like what are libraries that can be associated or work with the tool. Projects, you know, where is this thing being used in the real world out there to kind of get an idea of, like, is this thing going to stick around or are other people using it and so forth? I can kind of see that. And then media sort of promotion stuff like talks and podcasts. The podcast that I did is listed in the awesome list. So that's nice. So it's a good resource for learning more and getting more use out of this, or could be inspiration for how to use the tool. This list, again, it's on GitHub. as many awesome lists are. So definitely check out ones that for projects that you're interested in. Some highlights from it, they have a bunch of deployment templates. That's one of the things that I think is really cool about Marimo. Very often, if somebody's going to share something that they built in it, they can very often share it as like a web link and you can open it up in your browser and start playing with it, which I think is an amazing thing about the tool without you having had installed anything. It's using a lot of these great technologies that we've talked about on the show. There's another one, MKDocs Marimo, which is a plugin for reactive and interactive docs. Widget collections, some of the stuff that I really like about it is the interactivity, the ability to have like sliders and other kinds of widgets inside there. In fact, one that I really liked a lot is called MoDraw. It's built on top of TLDraw. And basically, you're inside of a notebook, but you can go in and just start drawing on it and, you know, making boxes, or you could type in text or what have you. I could imagine this being a really great tool for, again, as a person who makes video courses and does teaching and so forth, but to have your notebook with your code there and be able to draw on it and maybe you want to make a diagram or something else. And then it's right there inside the notebook and it's shareable as your creation. So some cool stuff there. So that's my project for the week.
Yeah, if you're trying to learn something new about like a new framework, a framework that's new to you is what I'm trying to say, Googling whatever the framework name is and then awesome list is a great way to get started, because pretty much everything that's out there has one. And I find particularly helpful for like coding examples, right? So
yes,
you know, I want to learn Django or Textual or Marimo or whatever. You go to an awesome list and you can find a dozen projects that use those frameworks. Then you can go through and see example code, which I find is the fastest way to learn how things can be done with a framework that's new to you.
Yeah. What's your project here?
I've got something called Mocha Pi. It's by Roman Kirev, who goes by Delirio on GitHub. Mocha is a Rust-based cache mechanism, and as you might guess by the name, Mocha Pi is a Python wrapper for it. Caching can be an important part of a project's performance, and if you're going to the trouble of optimizing with a cache, you probably don't want a slow one. So Mocha being Rust-based means that it's pretty quick. If you're trying to get going, the simplest entry point with Mocha Pi is a decorator for your Python code. The decorator takes arguments to specify how big the cache should be and other options that I'll get to in a second. And unlike the LRU cache that comes with Python, this one supports async. So this would be a reason to go to it if you were doing coroutines and async IO. Mocha gives you fine-grained control over your cache. When you set up a cache object, you specify how big it should be, as well as how items get removed from the cache, known as eviction. You can optionally set lifetimes, so an item won't be kept for more than, say, 10 seconds. There's also a policy control argument allowing you to specify either least frequently used or least recently used as your eviction policy. You can create a cache object and access it directly with set and get methods. So if the decorator isn't fancy enough, doesn't give you enough control, you can go through this mechanism instead. And there's also a callback, so you can register a listener for when an item gets evicted. So you pretty much can do all sorts of things with this. It gives you lots of control, lots of power. Definitely worth checking it out, especially if you're finding LRU cache isn't meeting your needs.
That's what I was thinking about the whole time. And then you mentioned LRU cache. I'm like, oh, cool. This will be nice. All right. Well, thanks for bringing all these PyCooters goodies this week. I'll talk to you soon.
Death to broccoli.
And don't forget to check out Propel Auth for all of your B2B SaaS authentication needs at propeloauth.com. That's www.propelauth.com. I want to say thanks to Christopher Trudeau for coming on the show again this week. And I want to thank you for listening. If you like the episode, a great way to help us grow our audience is to share it with other Python users who you think might enjoy it. You can also leave a rating or a review on your podcast platform of choice. If you or your company are interested in sponsoring the podcast, you can find all the information at realpython.com/advertise. You can find show notes with links to the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.